in case number 1730034, Levi Edward Garrett. There are four matters on the calendar this afternoon. Motions to dismiss filed by Great Western Bank in each case, in connection with which the parties have submitted briefs, and I am now prepared to enter oral rulings. And motions to approve a sale and lease back filed by debtors in 1730033 and by debtor in 1730034. Craig Nickram appears for Great Western Bank. Stan Anker appears for debtors. And Acting United States Trustee Jim Snyder appears in connection with the motion to dismiss in 30033. And I understand that Mr. Garrett, James Garrett, is also on the line. Craig Nickram appears for Great Western Bank. Jim Hurley appears for debtor. And Acting United States Trustee Jim Snyder appears in connection with the motion to dismiss in 30034. And Mr. Levi Garrett is also on the line. Stan Anker appears for debtors. Craig Nickram appears for Great Western Bank. And Acting United States Trustee Jim Snyder appears in connection with the motion to sell in 30033. And again, Mr. James Garrett is on the line. And Jim Hurley appears for debtor. Craig Nickram appears for Great Western Bank. And Acting United States Trustee Jim Snyder appears in connection with the motion to sell in 30034. And again, Mr. Levi Garrett is listening in on that one as well. I'm going to begin by noting debtors James and Sandra Garrett filed an amended disclosure statement and a modified plan at 10:16 this morning. Does that change your mind about wanting these cases dismissed, Mr. Nickram?
It does not, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Anker, did debtors sign their amended disclosure statement and modified plan in your presence?
Yes, in my office last night.
And you witnessed...
They were here.
You witnessed the two of them signing it?
Yes.
Okay. All right, then. Bank has issued evidentiary hearings on its motions to dismiss, asserting the records, the record that has been developed in each case standing alone establishes sufficient cause to grant its motions. Having reviewed those records, which in 1730033 now includes the amended disclosure statement and the modified plan that were filed less than 4 hours ago, and the parties' briefs, I agree. Debtors argue there are material facts in dispute, which they identify in their briefs, that necessitate evidentiary hearings. Bank suggests many, if not most, of those facts are either undisputed or irrelevant. Bank appears to be correct, however, so as not to further delay the disposition of these cases, which have already been pending far too long with little meaningful progress until this morning. For the purpose of the hearings, I am going to accept as true the facts identified by debtors. Turning first to the motion to dismiss James and Sandra Garrett's case, with certain exceptions that are not applicable in these cases, 11 U.S.C. Section 1112B1 provides, quote, on request of a party in interest and after notice and a hearing, the court shall convert a case under this chapter to a case under Chapter 7 or dismiss a case under this chapter, whichever is in the best interests of creditors and the estate for cause. Because debtors are farmers, I am barred by Section 1112C from converting their case to Chapter 7, so I do not need to decide whether conversion or dismissal is in the best interests of creditors and the estate. Section 1112B4 provides a list of acts and omissions that constitute cause for dismissal. In its motion, Bank first cites Section 1112B3 for the proposition that unreasonable delay by the debtor that is prejudicial to creditors constitutes cause. prior to the enactment of the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act, or BAPSEPA, that is in fact what Section 1112B3 provided. However, BAPSEPA deleted that provision and added a new Section 1112B3 that deals with the timing of the hearing on and disposition of motions to dismiss. Bank then cites Section 1112B4J for the proposition that the failure to file a disclosure statement or to file or confirm a plan within the time fixed by the code or by court order constitutes cause. However, while debtor's exclusivity period expired on March 23, 2018, I am unaware of any provision of the code or any order of the court that set a deadline by which debtors were required to file a disclosure statement or file or confirm a plan. And bank has not identified any such provision of the code or order of the court. Bank then cites Section 1112B4D for the proposition that the unauthorized use of cash collateral substantially harmful to one or more creditors constitutes cause. However, bank's argument presupposes the insurance proceeds at issue are its cash collateral. Debtor claims otherwise. And if I am to resolve the issue, Federal Rule of Bankruptcy Procedure 7001-2 requires either debtors or bank to commence an appropriate adversary proceeding to determine the extent of bank's lien. Bank then again cites Section 1112B4D for the proposition that failure to comply with a court order constitutes cause. I assume bank meant to cite Section 1112B4E because that is what that section, not Section 1112B4D, provides. In any event, bank identifies an order of the court with which it claims debtor's son Levi failed to comply, but it does not identify an order of the court with which it claims debtors failed to comply. And I am unaware of any such order. Bank then cites Section 1112B4F for the proposition that an unexcused failure to satisfy timely any filing or reporting requirement established by the code or by any applicable rule constitutes cause. Bank points to debtor's failure to seek or obtain court approval of their crop insurance settlement, but does not identify any filing or reporting requirement that debtors failed to satisfy timely. If the list of acts and omissions in Section 1112B4 was exhaustive, I would therefore be inclined, if not compelled, to deny bank's motion. However, it is not. Section 1112B4 says cause includes the listed acts and omissions. And under the rule of construction in Section 102.3, includes is not limiting. In its brief, bank returns to debtor's failure to seek or obtain court approval of their crop insurance settlement. Bank is correct in saying debtors were required by Federal Rule of Bankruptcy Procedure 9019 to seek and obtain such court approval. But not only were they required to do so, debtors were aware they were required to do so. In their August 13, 2018 response to a motion for relief from stay filed by Dear Credit, Inc., debtors stated in pertinent part, quote, "Presently, the court has not yet approved the insurance settlement, but once use of the proceeds is approved by the court, they will cure the default and pay any pecuniary loss." Despite their admitted awareness of the need for court approval, debtors did not seek or obtain such court approval. And debtors do not even attempt to explain or excuse their failure to do so. Debtors' blatant disregard of Rule 9019 is likely sufficient cause for dismissal. And the amended disclosure statement and modified plan debtors filed this morning do not alter that finding. Moreover, debtors' decision to then use the crop proceeds as they and they alone saw fit eliminates any doubt as to whether their case should be dismissed. Debtors argue those proceeds are not bank's cash collateral. However, that is for the court, not debtors, to decide. Bank has at least a colorable claim that the crop insurance proceeds are its cash collateral. And as I previously noted, the only way the issue can be resolved is by an appropriate adversary proceeding to determine the extent of bank's lien. Debtors did not commence such an adversary proceeding. They simply took the proceeds and spent some unspecified portion of those proceeds with total disregard for their responsibilities under the code. Without any legitimate attempt to explain or excuse their failure to do so, and without any showing that how they spent the proceeds was necessary, reasonable, and fostered their reorganization efforts. The amended disclosure statement and modified plan debtors filed this morning do not alter that finding either. Debtors' attitude toward their bankruptcy may be generously described as cavalier, and the fact they waited until this morning to file their amended disclosure statement and modified plan, far from changing my analysis of the case and bank's motion, actually provides further support for this finding. Debtors have availed themselves of the protections afforded by bankruptcy for almost 16 months, but they have not shown they are serious about reorganizing. They offer any number of reasons why there was no plan on the table until 4 hours ago, and they repeatedly promised a plan was coming soon, which is now technically true. But at the risk of sounding trite, I can only say actions speak, or in this case, inaction until virtually the last minute speaks louder than words. And while the proximity of debtors filing this morning to the hearing this afternoon limited my ability to fully analyze either debtors' amended disclosure statement or their modified plan, even the limited review I was afforded reveals significant problems with both. First and foremost, and what frankly troubled me the most this morning, was the fact that debtor Sandra Garrett's signatures are markedly different from her signature on a number of other documents previously filed with the court. For example, document numbers 36, 40, 216, 239, and 329. I do not pretend to be a handwriting expert, but the difference is so stark as to obviate the need for such expertise. However, given the fact that Mr. Anker has represented to the court that the debtors were in his office and signed the disclosure statement and plan in his presence, I suppose there's not much more I can say about that. Second, while debtors recognize they are liable for the full amount of certain claims, including banks, for which they and their son are jointly liable, they propose to pay only their, quote, share of those debts, without accounting for the possibility, no matter how remote, that their son, who has still, and I just checked, not filed a modified plan, might be unwilling or unable to pay his share either now or in the future. Third, debtors have not provided actual income and expense figures for 2017 and 2018, without which it is impossible to determine whether their income and expense projections are grounded in reality. Fourth, even if their income and expense figures are grounded in reality, debtors' cash flows appear to suggest after 5 years, the best-case scenario is debtors will have less than $35,000 of cash on hand. This is an absurdly thin margin for a multi-million-dollar operation such as debtors. Fifth, it is not readily apparent whether the sale referred to in Article 7 of the modified plan is the same sale and leaseback that is on the calendar today or an entirely different sale. Whether any such sale will in fact take place and how the proceeds of any such sale will be accounted for, other than debtor's vague reference to using the proceeds to reduce debt, what debt, and aid in the reorganization efforts, how? This underscores the fact that after nearly 16 months, debtors still do not have a cohesive plan on the table. Sixth, despite debtor suggestions to the contrary, unsecured creditors who will receive no payment until the sixth year of the plan and will not be paid interest are impaired. Seventh, while it is possible a majority of unsecured creditors might vote to accept such unfavorable treatment, I think it highly unlikely. And if a majority does not vote to accept debtor's plan, debtor's retention of any property other than that listed in Section 1115 will violate the absolute priority rule. For all these reasons, I find cause to dismiss debtor's case, notwithstanding their 11th hour filing. This is not the end of the court's required analysis, however. Under Section 1112b2, even if a court finds cause to dismiss a debtor's case, the court may not dismiss the case, quote, if the court finds and specifically identifies unusual circumstances establishing that converting or dismissing the case is not in the best interest of creditors and the estate, and the debtor or any other party in interest establishes that, A, there is a reasonable likelihood that a plan will be confirmed within the time frames established in Section 1121E and 1129E of this title, or if such sections do not apply, within a reasonable period of time, and B, the grounds for converting or dismissing the case include an act or omission of the debtor other than under paragraph 4A, for which there exists a reasonable justification for the act or omission, and that will be cured within a reasonable period of time fixed by the court. The code does not define unusual circumstances. However, the phrase contemplates conditions that are not common in Chapter 11 cases. In re Keeley, K-E-E-L-E-Y, and Grabansky, G-R-A-B-A-N-K-S-I, Land Partnership, 460 BR 520 at 536, Bankruptcy District, North Dakota, 2011. And unusual circumstances alone are not enough to bar dismissal. The unusual circumstances must establish that converting or dismissing the case is not in the best interest of creditors and the estate. In their brief, debtors claim such circumstances exist in this case. They do not, however, identify those circumstances, leaving me to speculate what those circumstances might be based on the record and debtor's recitation of alleged disputed material facts, which, as I said earlier, I am accepting as true for the purposes of this motion. Is Bank's alleged pre-petition conduct the requisite unusual circumstance? No. Bank's alleged pre-petition conduct is water under the bridge and is completely irrelevant to the issue of whether dismissing debtor's case today is not in the best interest of creditors and the estate. Are the hailstorms this past June the requisite unusual circumstances? No. First, I am not persuaded hailstorms, any more than floods or droughts or unseasonal snows or hungry insects, are uncommon in South Dakota. But even if they were, the fact that debtors suffered a crop loss 7 months ago does not establish dismissing their case today is not in the best interests of creditors and the estate. Debtors had ample time to deal with their crop loss, but still waited until 4 hours ago to put another plan on the table. Are debtors' post-petition interactions with bank the requisite unusual circumstances? No. First, I am not persuaded a debtor's having difficulty dealing with a lender that has not been paid in some time is uncommon. Second, debtors have not asked the court to involve itself in any of the matters about which they now complain. Consequently, I question how much of an impediment to reorganization those matters have been. But even if such interactions were uncommon, and even if they were an impediment to reorganization, they took place early in the case. They do not establish dismissing debtor's case today is not in the best interests of creditors and the estate. Is the time debtors are required to spend caring for their livestock the requisite unusual circumstance? No. To state the obvious, it is not uncommon for farmers and ranchers to work long hours. But even if it were, the fact that debtors may work longer hours than other farmers and ranchers does not establish dismissing debtor's case is not in the best interests of creditors and the estate. To the contrary, if debtors do not have time to deal with their bankruptcy, their case should be dismissed. Debtors do not get to ignore their bankruptcy or only pay attention to their bankruptcy when it is convenient for them to do so. Are the three pending state court matters the requisite unusual circumstances? No. Such lawsuits are common in Chapter 11. But even if they were not, their pendency does not establish dismissing debtor's case is not in the best interests of creditors and the estate. To the extent these lawsuits are truly preventing debtors from dealing with their bankruptcy, debtors should perhaps tend to the lawsuits first and, if necessary, return to Chapter 11 when they are in a better position to deal with their bankruptcy. It would be unreasonable to ask creditors to wait indefinitely for debtors to resolve these lawsuits before focusing their attention on their Chapter 11 case. Are debtor James Garrett's health issues the requisite unusual circumstances? No. It is not unusual for Chapter 11 debtors of any age to have health issues. But even if it were, the fact that debtor James Garrett may have health issues does not establish this missing debtor's case is not in the best interests of creditors and the estate. Much like the situation presented by the pending state court matters, to the extent debtor James Garrett's health issues are truly preventing debtors from dealing with their bankruptcy, debtors should perhaps tend to those health issues and, if necessary, return to Chapter 11 when he is physically able to deal with debtor's bankruptcy. Again, it would be unreasonable to ask creditors to wait indefinitely for debtors to address debtor James Garrett's health issues before focusing their attention on their Chapter 11 case. For all these reasons, I do not find and cannot specifically identify unusual circumstances establishing dismissing debtor's case is not in the best interests of creditors and the estate. Because Section 1112B is in the conjunctive, my inability to make this finding obviates the need for further analysis under that section. In sum, the record demonstrates debtors did not come prepared to reorganize and have been spinning their wheels ever since they filed for relief. While they may have made deals with certain creditors, until 4 hours ago, debtors had made little, if any, other significant progress toward confirming a plan during the almost 16 months their case has been pending. Which is not to suggest debtors' amended disclosure statement and modified plan represent significant process. To the contrary, for the reasons previously stated, they only represent more wheel spinning. And by settling their crop insurance claim without notice or court approval, and then spending an unspecified amount of those proceeds without the courts determining whether they were free to do so, debtors have created more, or if not more, then more substantial problems than they have solved. I am therefore granting Bank's motion to dismiss debtor's case. Turning then to the motion to dismiss Levi Garrett's case, the issues presented in this case are virtually, if not entirely, identical to those presented in his parents' case. Bank's briefs in the two cases are very similar, and the only readily apparent difference between debtor's brief in this case and his parents' brief in their case appears to be debtor's references throughout his brief to, quote, debtor and his parents, close quote, and debtor's parents' references throughout their brief to, quote, debtors and Levi, close quote. Under the circumstances, to save us all time and to avoid repeating myself unnecessarily, I will incorporate by reference my findings and conclusion in that case. And for the reasons previously stated in that case, I am also granting Bank's motion to dismiss this case. My decision to dismiss both cases renders moot the motions to sell real estate that are on the calendar this afternoon and the pending motions to use cash collateral that are set for evidentiary hearings on February 1 and February 7, respectively, and I will deny those motions for that reason. The court will prepare the orders. Thank you. Goodbye.